All right. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the School for Successful Ranching. My name is Ashley House, and I'll be moderating today's session. At this time, they've asked me to alert you all to place all your cell phones on silent, please, and remove your hats. If you need a place to put your hat, there should be a table in the back. We want to take this time to thank our generous sponsors for their support of the program and the commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the back of set up in the hallway of this floor, and we ask that you visit their booths and in the expo as well. We couldn't do this program without them. Sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Dow AgroSciences, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Merck Animal Health, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, Bayer, Microtechnologies, Diacero, Texas Range Minerals, Neogen GeneSeq, Rabo AgriFinance, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance, and Sylvius Insurance Group. If you're a new TSCRA member, they're asking me to tell you all that they're holding a new member orientation tomorrow. That's at 1 o'clock in room 101. And our first presentation is going to be a treat. The session is the start at the beginning. It's going to start at the beginning with soil health, presented by Dr. Charles Kneiper, or maybe not a doctor, sorry. Charles Kneiper. With NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service. So let's welcome Charles.
Good morning. So the title of this session that we've got going this morning is Starting at the Beginning, Soil Health. What we're really going to talk about is the art and science of resource management. We do talk an awful lot about the science, and there's a lot of things that we already know about the science. And so in some of that, we may say, well, we've heard this before. But we very rarely talk about the art of the science, how to put it into practice. So that's what we're going to try to do. But it's important that we start at the ground. We start with the soil. Because without having that soil and a healthy soil, everything above that's not really going to take place. So what we've got is we're going to talk a little bit about the science. That'll be what Nathan and myself will be doing. And then we have our artist over here, Deborah Clark, who will tell us how she applies different practices in different ways in order to achieve a certain goal on her property. So, Nathan?
Good morning. Does this work? Can you hear back over there? Good morning, everybody. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Is this better over there? Better? Okay. It's a real treat to get to visit with all of you. I know each of y'all have properties back home that you're managing. And so when we talk about resource management, especially in Texas, what would you consider to be the biggest limitation for any production? Cropping systems, forage-based systems? Guess? What? Water? H2O, right? So the question is, what are you doing to address that limitation on your operation? And this morning, thanks to our fancy technology, we're going to do a demonstration for hydrology. On the right, we have a planned grazing, rotational grazing system. On the left, we have year-round grazing. Cattle were put in, in the beginning of the season, grazed all the way through, and this is what it looks like today. I'll show the picture when we go through the PowerPoint presentation, but we're going to go ahead and put in a rainfall. Oh, everybody take a quick break, go get them a cup of coffee, we'll come back. What do you notice? What do you see? Well, number one, out of the season-long grazing with very little cover, we have lots of sediment movement, okay? On the other side, we have very little come out. So this is how much we have that infiltrated. And that's what we had infiltrate through that one. What's that? We'll show you in the presentation. But trust me, as much as I do this, it doesn't matter what part of the state you're in, it does the same. But it never just rains once, does it? It usually rains again. I'm going to leave this up here. During the break, you ought to come look at the surface of these soils. You wonder why people get upset that our rivers and our streams and our lakes all have too much sediment in them. What's the number one water pollutant we have across the nation? Not an element, it's sediment. But what's attached to that sediment is precious nutrients that should be used for plant production. So, let's see if this will work up here. So what we're going to talk about is speaking for the resource. Speaking for the what resource? The plant resource? The air resource? The soil resource? How about speaking for the resources? Because they're all interrelated. Soil health is about the interrelation between all of them. And so if we're not addressing some of these issues of hydrology, then how do we expect to get good plant production on our soils? Soil health, if you haven't seen it, is in every publication, farm publication you get today. It's somewhere in there. And so you go to looking at it, and what we like to say is that it's the capacity of the soil to function. And there's a lot of different functions in the soil that we need to understand and learn. And so this presentation is going to talk about that. What should we be looking for? What should we know about that resource, those resources, and how do we manage them? I apologize about my frog throat. Me and allergy have been fighting for a couple of weeks, and she's been winning. When you talk about resource management, I think it takes what's called the knack. We all need the knack.
I'm worried about little Dilbert. He's not like other kids.
What do you mean?
Yesterday, I left him alone for a minute, and he disassembled the TV, our clock, and the stereo.
That's perfectly normal. Kids take things apart.
Oh! The part that worries me is he used the components to build a ham radio set.
Oh, dear.
Is that bad?
Normally, I'd want to run an EEG on him, but the machine isn't working. Worse than I feared.
What is it?
I'm afraid your son has the knack.
The knack?
The knack. It's a rare condition characterized by an extreme intuition about all things mechanical and electrical and utter social ineptitude.
Can he lead a normal life?
No. He'll be an engineer.
No! There.
So for any of the engineers, I apologize. But it is quite funny because we have a lot of engineers in our agency, and every time I show that, they really get mad. They're like, you know, social ineptitude. about a year and a half ago, and we'll kind of go through that, there's anybody Twitter? Big Twitters around? So Twitter started something called hashtag SoilStar. And these are people who really, they speak for the resource. They know their country, they know soil function, and they work. You're going to get to listen to a hashtag SoilStar here in a little bit after the break, because her and her husband manage the land in a way that would put them in the SoilStar category. So what is a SoilStar? Back in Twitter, this friend of mine, Blake Vince, is talking about this Odette Menard. She's a worm guru. She knows more about worms than anybody in the world. She's from Canada, and he's like, I'm so happy that my Canadian friend Odette Menard is a rock star in the world of soil health. And a buddy of mine named Scott Ravenkamp says, no, it's not. It's not a rock star. It's a soil star. And there it was born, hashtag soil star. So I asked you, what's the difference between a soil star and a rock star? And at the end of the presentation, we'll go over that. But what is a soil star? So what we're going to talk about is five principles of ecology. Good. I like that. Is that better? Can you hear? Five principles of ecology. We call them five principles of soil health, but it's really five principles you need to start looking at on your operation to see if you're addressing those. To understand resource management, you understand that there's chemical, physical, and biological portions. It's a three-pronged stool of soil. And we need to know the chemical, the biological, and the physical attributes. For many, many, many years, agriculture industry has worked on, I don't know if my pointer works very well, this one and this one. Why haven't we focused on this one? What do you think health is when you go to the doctor? It's biological. Why haven't we focused on that one right there? You know why? Because you can't see it and it's hard. It's complex, and Mother Nature made it that way. And it's going to have a lot to do with what we consider a soil star. Biology is the big portion we need to start talking about. And it will be one of the biggest things to hit agriculture in the next 20 years. So if you're in forage-based systems, you're into soil health. If you're in crop production, you're into soil health. I spoke in Colorado the other day, and I told them, I said, there's two kinds of people. There's two kinds of people. There's those that have wild hogs, and those that are going to have wild hogs. And yet, we have not found that to be very profitable. Those pests are hard pests to deal with, okay? But I thought that was pretty funny, because they were like, oh, they won't come up here. And I'm like, you just wait. Know your resource. What are you managing? Do you know what soil types you have on your farm? Do you know what their characteristics are? This is what we consider the state soil of Texas. It's in the Blackland Prairie from basically Dallas all the way down to San Antonio. Houston black clay, 60% clay, heavy, heavy clay. You know, it's the type that when it gets dry, it cracks, and when it gets wet, it swells, and you can't open your doors, and you can't open your windows, and it's a foundation nightmare. All right, but what is the good things? Well, it holds a lot of water. The water holding capacity is really good there. Slow and very slow infiltration. That's not always good. We want that to be increased so that we can capture that water and not let it run off. High cation exchange capacity. The CEC is the ability of that ground to hold nutrients when you add them or when they are naturally made. If you're in sand and it rains 3 inches, all those nutrients went down. The reason why is because soil has a negative charge. Okay? It is negative. The clay particle is negatively charged chemically. So what is nitrate nitrogen? NO3 minus. NO3 minus. Two minuses don't attach. So you're going to have, you really need the plants and the biology in the soil to suck that up and take it. Because if not, the first rain you get takes that negative charge NO3 and leaches it out of the profile. Know your climate. Where are you? How many inches of rainfall you get? This is really funny in Texas. Everybody's like, how much rainfall do you get? There are no normals. Okay? Just because it shows that we get it like this, we can get 24 inches overnight. It happened in Corsicana back in what, 16, was it, or 15, October 15. Somebody asked a guy the other day, said, what's your rainfall? He said, we get 18 inches, 9 at planting and 9 at harvest. I was like, that's pretty close. So adapting to field conditions, that's another part of soil health. Soil health is understanding your resource and then adapting based on what you're given. What? Okay, I know the situation. I just got 9 inches of rain. What do I need to do? Okay, I've went 90 days without a tenth inch of rain. What do I do? That's adapting. And so, you know your climate conditions. This is pretty rough, from 53 to 22. That's Hillsboro. So the rolling plains, let's just go out west a little ways. Know your resource. What type of soils do we have? Are they deep? Are they shallow? Are they sand? Are they clay? Do they hold nutrients? Do they leach? What's the rainfall there? How does it work? Boy, I tell you, West Texas is fun. Anywhere from, 15.2 to 35.84. That's a big difference. You've got to be adaptive. And that's what soil health is about. Understanding the resource and then adapting to what you're given condition-wise. What can we change? You know, forever, you just thought dirt was dirt, right? We can't change it. We can't do anything with it. You're given what you're given. But we're finding that's incorrect. If we use these principles, we can quickly change the function of the soil. And those are dynamic properties. They change. Every day you take a soil test, you think, I've got something. The next day it's different. Why? Because of biology. Because then the biology that changes the chemistry in the soil, the biology that changes the physical properties of the soil. I like to say that the best tool that you have on your farm is your eyeballs and your brain. Okay? But the third best tool you have on your farm is one of these. And I don't mean a wooden handled one. I mean a steel one. Because sometimes it's so hard you can't dig without breaking your shovel handle. I've done it. Everybody ought to have one of these, and they ought to observe and monitor what you're doing on your farm with your moves, with your changes, with your decisions. I like to say it starts right here. Microbial activity runs the show, and we know so little about it, and we will always know so little about it. We just need to keep trying. We just need to keep chasing that to try to figure out more that we can. But as your biological activity changes, your organic matter content may change. The quality of the carbon in the soil is what we're after, not just the total amount, the quality, because those guys are looking for a quality. Once they get that, then you start getting aggregation and stability and porosity. That's what happened over here. When we ran this demo, and if you come up at break, you'll see a smooth pavement, and you'll see every raindrop intercepted by cover. That raindrop impact is a physical impact on that surface. And if it's bare, it's like a bomb going off. It breaks the particles apart. The particles start falling back on the surface. They start gelling together, and they form a seal, and water goes downslope. You need some cover to intercept that impact and let it infiltrate. Then these bugs start building these aggregates. If you see chocolate cake with that sharpshooter, you have good aggregation. If you see a 2x4, you have porosity. It's just not very much. Think about that. How much was a 1x4 holding water versus a sponge, an SOS pad? That's what you're after. You want that SOS pad with big macro pores. You want big BBs so that water can infiltrate. So then after we get some aggregate stability, we start holding some water. You saw the infiltration. If that profile is a 4-foot profile and it went down, it's going to come back up in the summer through capillary action. You're wanting a storage, a bigger bucket. I think I wrote that in the cattleman about a year ago. A bigger bucket. Make your bucket bigger. After that, we start getting into this. Now, I love telling the story, and I'll tell it as I get in a minute, but soil temperatures are huge on these guys. Implementing the ecological principles. We're going to talk about those five principles. Find a way to do that. I think the other two speakers are going to do an excellent job of showing you some of those. Principle one, boy, they messed it up when they keep it covered. I like the way that worked. Here is the core on the left that I got from a grazed pasture right now that has good cover. We saw what it did. It infiltrated all of it. You cannot build your resource if you have loss, right? Loss is loss. We have to eliminate loss. That is loss. You're not getting it back. Now, your neighbor might enjoy it, but there's NP and K in that. There's lots of organic matter flying off that field, running off that field with water erosion. We cannot have loss. Principle two, minimize the disturbance. This is where I took the right side. This is where I took the left side on that demo. Increase the organic matter in the biology. That's what we're after. If you go back here, and we're going to talk about energy some, but how much energy do we have going into that pasture versus the energy into that pasture? Where does our energy come from? Solar. Well, there's not enough leaf area there to do much solar capacity. But right here, we got a lot of photosynthetic capacity and photosynthetic rate coming into that. All of that energy goes into aggregation and goes into those right there. The biology that then break down the organic matter and make nutrients and make production for you. Here's a long-term field trial up in the Panhandle where they've done 30 years of no tillage. This is the same soil started the same 30 years ago with heavy tillage over and over and over. And we could do this in any landscape. This just happens to be a really good one. But if you continue to keep your bare soil bare, it starts ending up being a brick because of the sun heating it. The organic matter gets burned out, and you end up with a color gradient like this. That's 30 years. It doesn't take that long. We see color gradient changes within two or three when we start managing differently on our landscapes. Are we causing our own problem? So this is just a good example of temperatures. So on the right, we have a cover crop that was planted behind a conventional field. And on the left, we have the field that's been basically roller chopped. 108 versus 104 at the air temperature. 120 versus 100 at the 1 inch. And 102 and 92 at 3 inches below the ground. Stop wasting the water. Because on that bare ground, do you think you had more water than what that cover crop used? No, it evaporated. We'll get to that in a minute, but all that moisture that's in that soil over there with the green plants are using it, okay? There's no doubt about it. If you have a green plant, you're using up water. But guess what it's doing? It's building organic matter. Over here, there's a lot of water loss, but it's not doing anything for you. So, this was done back in 56 by J.J. McIntyre. He was actually here, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, still living in Comanche. And so he did some work that says, okay, 100% moisture is used for growth at 70. 15% of the growth is used for growth at 100. 100% of the moisture is used through evaporation or transpiration. And what do we cook our steaks to? 140, 150, why? To kill the bacteria. In June of 2011, I know none of you remember that, right? June of 2011, there was a bunch of Farm Bureau teachers that came. Charles and I were presenting at Stephenville, and we took them out to the university ranch. And as we got out of the vans, we walked over here, and we were standing here, and the whole crowd was over here in the road. We started talking, and they started dancing. And I said, what are y'all dancing for? One of them had just walked over there and got under the shade. It's about 102 outside. And they were dancing. They said, well, our feet are hot. And Charles said, walk over here. We were standing a little blistering about that tall. And as soon as they walked in, they were like, oh, my goodness. And I said, what's the air temperature where y'all were standing? I mean, what was the soil temperature where y'all were standing? And they were like, 102, 104, 105. Took out my trusty little thermometer and stuck it in the ground at 2 inches. It was 152 degrees. Smoked it, didn't we? Sun had bared down and killed, sterilized the whole soil. It was like 102 where we were. Under a thick cover. Those soil temperatures are vitally important, not just for the evaporation of water, but think about those bugs we're trying to help. How do you feel when it's 102 and you've got no cover? We need to understand that. Same way with the cold. Transpiration and evaporation. I like to say take the E out of ET. Evapotranspiration is all the water that's either lost from the ground to the atmosphere or it's sucked up by the plant and transpired through the leaves. If we could take the E out of ET, then most of it's going through the plant, building organic matter, building production. That's why we want cover. That's why we want soil temperatures low. That's why we did that demonstration over there. Principle three, diversity of plant types. We want legumes, we want grasses, we want deep-rooted crops. Now, this is a good example of something in a conventional, in a farming system, cropland system. But think about your rangelands. Have you ever walked through a good native prairie? How many species are there? Have you ever dug up those roots and see how deep they go? Some of them you might be there a while. But that diversity does the architectural work for soil function. Those deep-rooted crops are going down there and getting nitrate that has leached down and bring it back to the surface. Those aggregates, these right here are called rhizosheaths. Dig up your plants. There should be a sheath along that root in a circle all the way around it. You know what that's doing? That's an association between the plant and the soil. All the nutrients in the soil, all the bacteria, all the fungus, all that is over here, and the plant is accessing it. They have an association, and they'll start making those sheaths. That's what you need to see. As you start working, you start seeing these come in. So why does everybody love earthworms? Because they're good at fishing? Do we know much about an earthworm? So we all know they have segments, right? We've pulled up an earthworm. It's got all these little segments along the body. In each one of those segments are two nephridia, which are kidneys. And they're flushing out what they're eating, and they're kicking out nitrogenous gas. Nitrogenous gas is plant available, huh? So they're eating organic matter, and they're making nutrients for our plants. Now, there's segments that sometimes don't work. There's two per segment, and there's a lot of segments. And if you pull out 25 worms in a shovel slice, that's 1 million worms per acre. You start getting 1 million segments kicking out nitrogen, it's no wonder you can get some pretty good production on native ground when it rains, when we have the functioning soil. Because you didn't add any fertility to it, did you? Not on your native pastures. But that's why it's so important. Worms can come back if you will minimize your disturbance. And I think managing disturbances is going to be a word you hear today, because sometimes we do want disturbances. That's what we're after. But you need to know what the disturbance is that you're doing. Compaction. Again, functioning soils don't have compacted layers. We form those through our management. How do you mitigate them to get rid of them? Through plants. Plant roots, deep roots, different types of roots. Do they do the work? Not really. They just make a really nice big hole so that the 2-inch rain we get puts the water right down in contact with the problem. And then the bugs working through that soil, especially the earthworms, will do the engineering. And they'll start breaking that up. Invest in biology. So we took a soil sample, we being Charles, myself, and a couple of our cohorts, in a field where there was just worm cast everywhere. So we just gathered up the worm cast, put it in a bag, gathered up the soil down to 0 to 6 inches, and sent them to the same lab and said, here, run it for us. They came back, and this is what we found. The worm cast had 130 units of N, 22 P205, and K2O226. The rest of the soil had 25, 16, and 49. I think that shows that if we can get a lot of worms, they do a lot of work. They can process a lot of nutrients, which then goes into plant production, can be utilized by that plant growing. Principle four is keep something living. We talked about energy, right? If you have a fallow time where nothing's growing on that field, you have what we call a sunshine spill. You didn't catch any sunshine, did you? You didn't put any energy from that solar power into our ground because it didn't have a living green photosynthetic root. Leaf. We've got to have photosynthesis. We all talk about soil is the foundation of life. Soil's actually not. Photosynthesis is our foundation. Photosynthesis then has such a high relationship with the plant, the bug, and the soil that it lives in. They're interconnected. They don't know the difference. Without one, you don't have the other. So plant them all and let Mother Nature sort it out. What that means is diversity. Don't just stick with one type. You don't know what that's doing for you. If that's all that you're growing, then that's all the amount of biology that's going to survive on that. If you have a lot of diversity, if you have a lot of different types of plants, then you have a lot of different microbes that are growing in association with that plant. Therefore, you're increasing the biomass of the biology in the soil, and therefore making more nutrients and more function. Here's a good example. This is just a warm and cool season mix that we planted in the late summer that was able to do a little bit of legume work in the summer, but then we had winter species as well that were able to be overseeded. And so if you, and it's a challenge, it's tricky, but in forage-based systems like Bermuda grass, we've been working to try to overseed these in the fall. And the timing is critical, and sometimes you don't get real happy because the production for some of these don't really come on until February and March because it's so cold in the winter. You're like, well, I just put a lot of money in that, but did I do anything? Well, you did a whole lot for the herd underground. You might not have done a whole lot for the herd above ground as far as biomass production, but underground, they're like, thank you. I have carbon coming out of those roots. I have sugars being exuded. I can keep doing my work all winter long. And it ends up paying. You have to be patient, though. So we're trying to build a good home. That is not a good home. Those are bricks. It's called angular blocks. They look like ice cubes, big ones. Then you get into small blocking. That's getting better. But what you really want is chocolate cake, what we call crumb structure. We want those aggregates so that roots can move through freely, water can infiltrate through, and we're getting away from no porosity. We are trying to work on these guys. And we all talk about organic matter, bacteria, and fungi. But we don't talk about these guys. That's the third, fourth, fifth trophic level. This right here, protozoa, good example. That body is 30 parts carbon to one part nitrogen. All right? Their main food source is bacteria. That is 5 parts carbon to 1 part nitrogen. Now I went to school at Tarleton, and I don't know much about math, so bear with me. But how many bacteria does that protozoa have to eat to get 30 parts carbon? If one's 30 and the other one's 5, how many bacteria did it have to eat? Is that 6? 6 times 5? It also took in 6 what if it took in 30 carbons? It took in 6 nitrogens, right? But all of its body needs is 1 nitrogen, 30 to 1. What did it do with the other 5 nitrogens? Kicked it out for plants to use. It's a predator-prey relationship. We have to have predators eating on the prey and kicking out the nutrients that they ingest. And if we don't have those, if we stop that right there, we're missing a lot of nutrient cycling out there in our soil's function. Decomposition. In Texas, we decompose things very fast because we're very hot. And biology stays very active because of the temperate weather. So, everybody just says, well, we just burn it up so fast. That just means you need to make better management systems to leave more. That means you need to get it functioning so you produce more. Once you do that, then you can start managing those reserves to keep the ground covered and let it function. Platy structure. We talked about chocolate cake and aggregate stability and porosity. Well, platy structure doesn't allow for root movement. It doesn't allow for water infiltration. Poor organic matter, massive structure, is horrible for traffic because every time you drive across it, it squeezes more air out. And then you have ruts and you have more compaction. You have all these issues. We have to work to stay off of our soils when they're wet. We have to know what our disturbances look like. This is a good example. When you have these two types, either single grain or granular, it allows vertical movement of water. When you have platy or massive, you have very slow movement of water. And what happens a lot of times is it won't infiltrate, so it sets on the surface and it evaporates first before it infiltrates. That's not a very good management of our water resources that we're given. The fifth principle is proper integration of livestock, and I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to put this up here and let you know that it's a principle because the next two we're going to really talk about the art and science of grazing. But think about all the things that she and her and the little one bring to your operation. We have feces and urine. We have milk foam. We have saliva. We have hair. And then we have transfer systems. You can really build your soil by including livestock, and all of you do. I talk to a lot of folks who don't. But bringing livestock in can really be a benefit, and managing them correctly can speed up the process of soil health. Challenges, each of our paths will be different. Whether you're getting 60 inches of rainfall or 6, it's not going to be the same. The principles hold true, but the way you go about getting those implemented will differ. Understand your system. One of the soil stars that I work a lot with is Rick Bieber, and he says, guys, understand your system. I've worked so hard to understand my system, understand my soil resource, understand the resources around me. Have some passion and desire. Why are we doing this? To build the future, right? To build the next generation. Be adaptive and patient. Adaptive. That's what those bugs are. They adapt to what you give them. We have to adapt to what we're given. Once we understand, we can start making some alternatives and choosing those alternatives to get the outcome that we want. Communicate with your neighbors and landowners. This is really a social issue a lot of time on soil health, because you can say, okay, well, I know to do this, and I know to do this, and I know to do that, and you go to the co-op, and they go, what are you doing? Are you crazy? I'm going to call the landlord and take that farm. I'm going to take that ranch because you don't know what you're doing. It's a social issue, so be communicative. Get some people around you. See what they're doing. Work together. Set goals that you can attain. I see this all the time. People come in and they say, I want to do this. And they're 20 years down the road with all their goals. And 2 years later, they're so depressed because they couldn't reach one of them, because they were looking at long-term goals. Have short-term goals. Say, that's what I want to do in a year. That's what I'm doing 5 years and 10 years. That 1 year gives you the confidence to go a little bit further. It gives you that, okay, I got that one. Now let's try something else. Think long term. Don't wait too late to think about, and I'm going to scratch out sustainable. I'm tired of that word. I hear it all the time. But what is it? Think about regenerative. That's what we're after. I don't want my bank account just to sustain. I want it to increase. I want to regenerate it, somehow make it better. That asset that we're managing out there called our land needs to be regenerated. So what's the difference between a rock star and a soil star? After this presentation, I hope you'll see it's adaptive and malleable. Rocks break. Soils bend. They're malleable. That's what a soil star can do. He can understand, she can understand her resource, and she can adapt to get it to function the best that she can. Lack of knowledge is not the problem. Egos and prior knowledge block learning. And I see this all the time. Our prior knowledge and the egos that we have keep us from going forward because we're set in our ways. We have to think about that. We have to change our mindset, and we have to grow our operation. This is what's important. That whole system. Our food, our animals, our plants, our soil, our microbes. I think it starts right here, and then it's a cycle. In RCS, we don't discriminate. Here's your nice little disclaimer, and there's my contact info. Charles, we're about 10 after. I think you can go till 11, and we'll keep questions. If you have a question, write it down. At the end of the session, I think all three of us will be up here, and you can just shoot it. All three of them.
Thank you, Nathan.
Do you want this?
I got one. Is it not working? All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about resource management. To follow up with a little bit of what Nathan was talking about, but we, within RCS, we get to deal with a lot of people, and we have to, you know, make a start somewhere. And, of course, in RCS, we always hear the story that we start out as a Soil Conservation Service, or the SCS. And so it's important to remember that we still have that as a priority, as our soil resource. That's our foundation, that's what we want to take care of. But from that, By title, I'm a range management specialist, so I actually deal with the forge base on top of the ground, and Nathan gets carried away with the soil, and I'm like, Nathan, settle down. But he brings a different perspective. And unfortunately, Nathan, I failed to put my perspective slide in here like you asked me to. But what I do want to bring up is one of the things we have to do when it comes to changing our mind, like Nathan was just saying, is we do have to change our perspective. You know, I think about a football team, you know, or a football game. You have the winning team and you have the losing team. The winning team thinks it was a pretty good game, don't they? The losing team usually doesn't. It's all in their perspective of how they look at it. Well, many years ago when we started working on a water quality project, we were visiting with an individual, and this is a cropland story, so nobody get upset with a range person talking about cropland. But we asked the guy, what are you wanting to do? And he said, I want to produce 200 bushel corn. I said, okay, so what are you doing to do that? He said, well, you know, I plow and I put out fertilizer and I do this and I do that. We said, okay, what's your limiting factor? And he said, of course, water. And so we asked him, how is plowing and putting out fertilizer affecting your limiting resource? What are you doing to get what you want? He said, well, I don't know. And we said, what you're actually doing is you're managing what you have. You have equipment, you have a checkbook, and that's what you're using, and you're managing that. You're not managing for what you want. What I'm asking you to do is to start changing your perspective from the standpoint of managing what you have into thinking about what it is that you want and managing for what you want. Now, again, we're talking about the art and the science, and so a lot of what this talk is going to be is just about the science. A lot of this, everyone in here probably already knows. They've probably heard 100 different talks that talk about this process that I'm going to go through, okay? But at the end of the day, what I want to make a point of is we know the science. We've talked about the science. It's our implementing that science in the way that we want to that's the key here. So we start doing our resource management. You know, there's not just one thing. It's not just grazing management or nutrient management or something like that. We have to put everything into a system and into a process so that we come up with a final product. But we still have to know what we have. We have to know what we have so that we know how to manage for what we want. Okay, so we need to know how many acres we have. We need to know how many grazable acres we have. How many people in here know how many acres they have on their property? Okay. How many people in here know how many grazable acres they have? Because typically people don't think about the grazable acres. We also want to know about our soils. Nathan had some pretty good information up there about the soils and their different capabilities. We have to know what those are. You know, if you don't know what those capabilities are, you start having high expectations. And then you fail to meet those expectations and you say to yourself, well, dadgummit, this doesn't work. Well, that's not the case. Your soil can give you as much as it can based on what it's capable of doing. All right? So if you're on a shallow soil that's going to produce, at best, 3,000 pounds per acre, don't expect to get 8,000 pounds per acre on that soil. If you have that type of expectation, you're going to become very frustrated. Know what your ecological sites are. Ecological sites respond differently to management. They're just a set of a plant community, soils, and the hydrologic functions that go on that site. Know what these are on your property. They respond differently to different types of management. Okay? Know what they're going to do. Know the direction that they're going to move. Nathan and I were talking to our boss one day. This was many years ago, and we got to talking about a certain ecological site. And it was probably the first time in my career that it dawned on me that by knowing the soil, knowing what the parent material was for that soil, would actually dictate the direction that that ecological site would go. That it would either, we were asked if the parent material was sandstone or limestone. And we were told, well, if it's this one, then that community is going to move to a mesquite-dominated community. But if it's this one, that community is going to move to a prickly pear-dominated community. Well, all of a sudden now, if you know what you're going to be looking for, you have your indicators of what you need to be watching for in the future to see if you need to be adaptive and make a change to your overall management. Know where your water is, know if it's dependable or not, and know your vegetation. You know, we get told all the time that you can't manage what you don't know. Start learning those plants out there, identifying those key plants. Know what plants you want to see out there. We talk about how grasses grow. This is what's happening, you know, above ground now. We're starting to get up and above, you know, that soil resource. But yet, we still have to have that soil resource to support that plant. And I've heard some people make comments about this of, well, this is why we want to keep that leaf area, because 95% of the food is from that solar energy that's coming down there. But don't forget, if you don't have that 5% of the food that they need from the soil, you're still not going to get your total production. You're not going to get your capabilities. While it may be able to take that solar energy and do photosynthesis and make its production, you only get as much production as your limiting resource. And if your limiting resource is in that soil, it becomes your important factor to watch. So we talk about kind of how we want to manage our forage base out there, and there's a lot of statements as far as, you know, you gotta, you know, take half, leave half, and, you know, don't graze this too short, or, you know, this grass is meant to be grazed short or whatever. At the end of the day, what you need to remember is it takes grass to grow grass. Okay? If you don't have any grass out there, it's going to be real hard to grow some more grass. All right? And this is where we start getting into where we want to keep in mind when we talk about principles, we want to keep that ground covered. Okay? First and foremost, I don't care what cover it is, we want to keep the ground covered for many reasons. Keep it covered, we're going to stop erosion. If we can stop erosion, we're keeping our soil resource, which is what we need to have in place in order to have anything beyond that. Remember, we're starting at the ground, moving our way up. So when we get into this, we start getting into our fence line contrasts and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to focus, you know, on the left side of this fence, we've got quite a bit of forage, and on the right side of the fence, we've got bare ground, essentially. The idea of take half, leave half on when we're going to do our grazing out there, half of what's on the left-hand side of that fence is still greater than all of the grass that's on the right-hand side. Again, think about it from the standpoint of you got to have grass to grow grass. Okay? Manage for what you want. If you want grass, you've got to manage it to have grass. So we're getting into talking about grazing management with these resources, and Nathan, you talked about, you know, proper integration of livestock. The key word there is proper. Just because you have livestock on the property does not mean that you're implementing them properly. Okay? You've got the livestock that serve as your production tool that you're going to actually take and market so that you can make some money. Okay? But at the end of the day, that's also a tool. That's your tool that manages your landscape. That's one of the tools that you use to alter what that vegetative state is out there. Okay? You can do a lot of different things with it. But by the same token, you can improve your land with your tool, but at the same time, you can do a lot of damage with that tool if you don't manage it properly. And again, this is where it comes back to think about what it is that you want. What is that goal that you have in mind, so that you can pay attention to certain key indicators to get there. So, we talk about in grazing management, we want to talk about take half, leave half. Does everybody know what take half, leave half is? The idea being is that of all the forage that's produced out there, that's grazable, that our animals can consume, We want to leave half of it on the landscape, and we want to take half of it. Now, the overall problem is, there's a couple of problems. One is that take half doesn't actually mean take half. Okay, what our animals are actually getting to harvest or take for their own is about half of the half, so 25%. So they have a 25% harvest efficiency. But this is also where another problem comes in. I think for a long time when we've talked about this take half, leave half, we still always end up focusing on the half that we take. Again, let's change our perspective. We want to focus on the half that we're going to leave. Why do we want to leave that half? If we remember some of what Nathan was talking about, we're going to keep cover out on the ground. Okay? That half that we leave becomes that residue that starts breaking down, feeding the microbes. It becomes some of that organic matter that goes into the soil to help with aggregation. Okay? If we change how we approach this and say, okay, I understand take half, leave half, and I understand that of the half I take, it's just, you know, half of that. But I have to remember what I'm leaving on the ground. The only way you're going to be able to take care of your soil is when you actually start thinking about what you're putting back into your soil. I'll ask this question. I don't know what kind of response I'll get, but does anybody in here run cattle? Okay. When it comes time to, say, supplement your cattle, do you pay attention to the supplement that you put out? Do you pay attention to the type of feed that you're giving them? Do you pay attention to the type of mineral that you're giving them? Because you want to make sure that they're able to produce as best as they can. Is that a correct statement? Okay, if I want my soil to produce as best as it can, shouldn't I pay attention to what I'm feeding it? Change your perspective. Think about the half that you're giving to that soil. So we get the question, how many animals can I run? Everyone wants to come in and say, what's the general or the average stocking rate? And I can tell you all this, there's not one. But if you want to know what it is across the entire state, I have yet to meet somebody that has told me a number different than a cow to 20 acres. I hear that all across the state. Get that out of your head. That's not how stocking rate works. Okay? Stocking rate works based on what you have on your property and what you're producing today. This is where we get into that questionable stuff of managing what you have versus managing for what you want. Okay? Because at some point you still have to use what you've got. It's how you treat it on if you're going to move in a positive or negative direction. All right? But what you've got to do is be able to calculate that stocking rate. How many animals can I have out here and still be able to move in the direction that I want or stay where I'm at? Maybe you're right where you want to be. How do you maintain that? Either way, like Nathan said with rainfall, we don't get the same rainfall every year. We don't get it at the same time every year. We still have to be adaptive to what's going on out there so that we can maintain our animals in a manner to keep what we've got or move in the direction we want to go. To do that, we need to know two things. We need to know how much those cows want to eat, and we need to know how much we're producing. We're balancing forage supply and animal demand. Overall, I hate to say it, and for Nathan, it's always a trick since he's from Tarleton, but this is basic math. But when you think about it, how many people actually monitor what you've got in your forage out there? How many of you know how much forage you're producing on your property? I've got one with a half-hearted hand raise. How do we know how many animals we can have if we don't know what we're producing? So how are we going to move in the direction we want to go? How can we manage for what we want if we don't even know what we have? So you estimate your available forage, and it's estimation. On any given day, whatever it is today is going to change tomorrow because of how the weather may be. But One of the things you can do, and unfortunately we don't have any in this room today, but I think everyone has seen those grazing sticks that NRCS can sometimes give out, or the Grazing Land Coalition. But that's a yardstick. I'm sure you can find a yardstick somewhere. There's a lot of people who have a yardstick in their house, whatever it may be. But if you take a yardstick and square off a few plots out on your property, on your grazable acres, and when you know what your plants are and you know what plants your cows eat, and you clip those to get an idea of that production, you can clip everything in that square yard, get it air dry. Okay? When you get it air dry, sometimes people like to put it in a microwave, which can sometimes make the wife mad, or it can make your house smell really good, or it can cause a fire. Nathan. Anyway, you take that dry weight and you multiply it by 10.7, and that'll give you your pounds per acre. Ideally, you'll have clipped more than one plot, so you take the average weight within all those plots, so you get an average production. Average production per square yard times 10.7, and you're going to get your pounds per acre. You clip it down to the ground, so you get total production, and now we can start doing some of that math of take half, leave half, to get to the point where we know how much available forage for our livestock to consume. So in this case, plot weight air dried was 200 grams. 200 grams by 10.7 is 2,140 pounds per acre. That's what we're producing. So now our animal demand, we talk about this in the sense of an animal unit, which would be a 1,000-pound cow and her calf. We talk about animal unit equivalents. If you're somebody that has multi-species, you know, if you run sheep or goats or llamas, whatever it may be. But since we're here at the cattle raisers, we'll just talk about cows. All right? So we want to know, what is our animal demand? Well, we know that a 1,000-pound cow, on average throughout the year, will consume about 2.6% of their body weight per day. And then when you say that for 365 days, we come up with this forage amount for 9,490 pounds per animal unit per year. All right? Now again, that's for your animal unit. What's the animal unit? That's right, it's a 1,000-pound cow and her calf. So we're going to take that weight, our harvest efficiency at 25%. We have available forage of 535 pounds per acre of available forage for grazing. You divide what an animal needs for a year, divide it by what you've got available for grazing, it tells you an initial stocking rate, in this case, of 18 acres per animal unit. But the question is, are we done? What have I not accounted for? That's... What do you mean, use it all? I did. I've already accounted for the 25% harvest efficiency. But I didn't account for my grazable acres. This right now is based off of all acres. I got to also know what's ungrazable. So if I have 30% that's not grazable due to whatever it may be, I start working on that with my grazable acres. So I have 18 acres per animal unit. With my 70% grazable acres, all of a sudden now my stocking rate became 26 acres per animal unit. This is where knowing what your grazable acres are becomes very important, because you can end up getting into an overgrazed situation. I talk to some people and they tell me, well, all of my land is grazable. And that's what we're looking at. Is that grazable to you? That's not grazable acres. You have to account for that kind of stuff. You don't have animals wanting to go through there to graze. And we know that not all animals are equal. We talked about that animal unit being a 1,000-pound cow and her calf. Charley Bull over on the left, he weighs a little more than 1,000 pounds. I have a picture of three cows side by side. Do those three cows look like they all weigh the same? Three different sizes of cows right there. And I would venture the statement that not one of them is 1,000 pounds. How many people in here actually have a 1,000-pound cow? I saw some raise your hands in here. Are you sure that they're 1,000 pounds? Oh, you have 1,000 pounds. Okay, got you. I got you. Point being, you need to account for the fact that cattle these days, it's very rare that you're finding that 1,000-pound cow. Now, there's some people that are starting to select for that in their breeding operations, but there's still some that are keeping that 1,200-pound cow or whatever. Keep in mind, when you think about how much they consume, you have to account for their weight. So we get into talking about how much residue then we want to leave at the end of that year. Tall grass, short grass, mid grass. So when you think about it in the idea of take half, leave half, how much I'm leaving back in a tall grass community that can produce about, 6,000 pounds, half of that's going to be about 3,000. But if you get into a short grass community that's only producing about 1,000 pounds, of course, 50% of that's going to be 500 pounds. You see, your plant community tells you how much residue you're going to be able to leave back and how much you're going to be able to feed. This concept, though, is one that I think escapes a lot of people in them understanding how their residue can affect their soil, okay? When you think about this, I've got to have a soil that can produce that tall grass community. Typically, I can't move from a short grass community to a tall grass community. I have to work my way up from short grass to mid grass to tall grass. Why is that? When I start leaving some of that residue back, I start building that soil function. But that soil function has to get going. It's kind of like a snowball. Snowball starts out small. It doesn't go from small to big, right? I have to gradually build on that snowball, right? So that's what's happening here. We go from the short grass. As I start leaving the right amount of residue back, I start feeding that soil, and the soil starts, I'll put in air quotes, growing. As that soil grows, it starts needing to eat more. It becomes a teenager. So now we get into the midgrass community. It starts eating. We have to leave more food back for it. It grows up again. Now we're into the tall grass. We got to feed it more. And that's just to maintain what we have. Remember, Nathan was talking about regenerate. We want to build on it. Manage for what you want. So I put this slide up here. This is a slide where we start talking about how much residue we leave back. And, of course, I made the statement earlier, you got to have grass to grow grass. This is talking about the residue that was left at the end of the grazing season. On the left-hand side, these are January forage residue amounts. The left-hand side, it was 100 pounds of residue per acre. In the middle, we have 500 pounds, and on the right, we have 1,500 pounds of residue per acre that was left. All right, that's what we had in January. Now, there's some small numbers up there that tell me how much rain that I received for that next year, okay, for that growing season. And then the red bars themselves are actually telling me how much I produced in the year. So, on the left-hand side, in January, we had left 100 pounds of residue. For the year, then, we received 16.9 inches of rain, and that site produced just under 2,000 pounds of forage production that year. Okay? There in the middle of the 500 pounds, it received 16.5 inches of rain, and it produced, about 3,700 pounds of forage in a year, in that year. Now, on the right-hand side, where we left 1,500 pounds, it received 9.7 inches. It was just a little above half the amount. But the kicker here is it still produced almost 4,000 pounds of forage. Okay, you got to have grass to grow grass. But what are we seeing happen here? This is going to be one of those things where I say change your mind and change your perception. All right? We left grass. We had residue. We had enough grass to leave that amount of residue. meant we were feeding that soil. We had a soil that had good organic matter, good aggregation. It allowed water to infiltrate. It didn't run off. We didn't lose any of our soil resource. Now, all of a sudden, we had that sponge beneath that grass. It took in that water. Now we have water that's available for those plants to grow. All right. Manage for what you want. We've got to look at effective rainfall. I love to hear people talk about how much rain they got. Several years ago, I lived down close to Kerrville, Texas. And on the 4th of July weekend, we received, in 24 hours, 40 inches of rain. So at the end of the year, you know, we were able to say we had 50 inches of rain that year. Well, what do you think the vegetation looked like? It looked like we'd been in a drought. It looked bad. What good does it do to get all that rainfall if we can't get it in the ground? Okay? If you get well-timed rain and you've managed your land properly to take it into the soil profile, you don't have to get 50 inches of rain to be able to produce a lot of forage. The kicker here is you've got to be able to catch it. Catch that water. So again, if I'm going to do something to manage my land for what I want, and if I'm truly trying to address my most limiting resource, which, what is the most limiting resource? We talked about it earlier, water. We got to get it in the ground. We got to keep that ground covered. We got to allow that rain and that water to get in. We've got to be able to get better grazing distribution across all of our landscape. We can talk about grazable acres, but does that mean that they're using them? Possibly not. Not if we don't have water well dispersed, not if we don't, or if we have a lot of topography, or if we don't place mineral or have our supplemental feeding areas in the right places. We can't usually affect their grazing distribution. This is where we've got to start working into certain grazing strategies and how we're going to get animals to move around. There's many types of grazing strategies that can be used. Okay, I'm not going to talk about systems because of systems, in my mind, indicate that it's a cookie cutter that can be used. And I do not want to give the perception that we're using cookie cutters. There's not a cookie cutter system that you can use on your place. The type of strategy that you use is the type of strategy that you're capable of using. We talk about stockpiling hay. There's a lot of talk that people get into about, you know, if you're feeding hay in Texas, you know, you're not grazing properly. I'm not going to get into that discussion right here. What I am going to tell you is that if you do have a management style that allows you to grow a pasture or two pastures where you have standing hay, all of a sudden you're not having to cut it, you're not having to put it up, you're not having to put it out in the winter or whenever it is that you're needing to feed it. Okay, this becomes a situation where you might have some standing hay and your supplementation becomes putting out some protein. And then we can get real lazy and put out protein tubs or whatever, and we don't even have to go out there. That's the way I operate. I'm lazy. But we do talk about rotational grazing strategies. The key here is that in a rotational grazing strategy, we are trying to give our plants the ability to recover. They have to be able to recover from a grazing incident. They have to be able to recover from some other form of disturbance that's happened out there. You know, Nathan said minimize disturbance on his five principles. They're not his, they're nature's. But what we do really is we manage that disturbance. There's certain things that we're able to manage. You know, we can manage when livestock are in a pasture or when they're not in a pasture. We can't manage that drought, but if we do get a drought situation, we can then take steps on what we do control, the livestock movement, on where we put them. So we're going to manage the disturbance to make sure that we get plenty of rest and recovery on those plants. You've got to pick the strategy that's going to work for you. We've got some people that are really big on wanting lean beef now. You know, there are strategies that get you what you want, but it's not always what you want, okay? Most people aren't wanting to run cattle like this. So keep in mind, if your cow pies are stacking up a little bit higher than your grass, you probably have a grazing problem. I think Nathan said, talk about being adaptive. This is where we want to be flexible. Be flexible. Know that you're not going to get that normal rainfall year in and year out. You have to make changes to what nature is giving you and be ready to do whatever it is to address that contingency plan. And I say just a contingency plan because sometimes it may not necessarily be a drought that's your contingency plan. There may be some other issues that come up that becomes your contingency plan. But sometimes this is the best way to adjust your numbers. We've got to be willing to do that. And I hear some people talk about, well, I can't sell my cows now because the market's not good. Okay, from my perspective, and I want y'all to know I have to speak from two hats here because I do run cattle. But at the same time, from a range management perspective, if I want to maintain my forage base, and if I want to maintain my land and be able to improve my land so that I can still be running cattle in 5 years, I might need to go ahead and sell them today, whether the market's good or not. Sometimes this isn't about the production side of things. This is about protecting your resource. This is about managing for what I want. And what I want is I want to run cattle in 5 years. I want to run cattle in 10 years. If I don't take proper steps today, I won't be able to do that. So that's all I've got. I think what we'll do right now, I don't know what time it is, Nathan. 10:45. So right now we'll take a 15-minute break. At 11 o'clock we'll get started up again with Miss Clark. So use the restroom, get a good stretch, get a drink, and then we'll get started in 15 minutes. Start it again. Our next speaker, I'm going to start making some excuses real quick, too. When Nathan and I were putting this session together, we wanted to bring in, you know, a couple or three artists to talk about how they implement these principles, okay? And that's where we want to talk about the art of applying this science, okay? Well, we started getting some people back out on us and everything, so we only have one artist to speak to us today. But Mrs. Clark will go ahead and give a talk about how...
Okay.
She will, how she implements these things. But real quick, a couple of quick announcements here. Number one, if you have any questions, you can come by the NRCS booth. It's booth 1043. We've got people down there that'll be able to answer any questions. We'll have occasional videos playing or whatever showing. I think they're going to try to show some of these presentations in a condensed version. But also, anybody that wants to get more information on calculating that stocking rate, there's going to be another session this afternoon at 3:30, and we've got two individuals, Stephen Dice and Calissa Garland, are going to be talking a little bit more about calculating those stocking rates.
Thank you. Thank you. Is this too loud? It's okay? Right. Okay. Well, thank you for being here this morning. Thank you for letting us take up some of your time. And I hope what we're giving you is something of value. I mean, that's important. You've spent some time here, and so I hope we give you back something that you remember when you leave. First of all, nobody's ever called me an artist. Nobody's ever called me an artist. I don't have a single artistic bone in my body. And the second thing is, I'm not a hashtag soil star. Now, one time, I will admit that I did want to be a rock star. My goal in life was to be Tina Turner. Now, I know that Tina Turner is a whole lot... Oh, yeah, we got somebody of my age group that wants to be Tina Turner. But there were two problems with being Tina Turner. One, I can't dance. And number two, I can't sing. But I wanted to be her. So now if I can just aspire to be a soul star, maybe we'll make up for that lost ambition. There are three things I want you to take away today. Number one is that we're all on a learning curve. I'm 66 years old. My husband is 67 years old. And we're learning and continuing to learn every day about what the impact is of the way we decide to manage. So I hope that all of you realize it's not too late. We're all always on a learning curve. The second thing is that the management and practices we put in place are critical. Only difference, when you looked at some of those fence lines where Nathan or Charles showed you what pasture looked on one side and what pasture looked on the other side, the only difference there is a fence, an owner, and management. Now, I stole that from Soil Carbon Cowboys. If you want to go look at a great website, you go to Soil Carbon Cowboys. Huh, Justin? Soil Carbon Cowboys, you go there and you look at the videos that are offered up and the education you can get from that. And the third thing I want you to take home today is that you make a difference. You can make a difference. It matters not if you have 1 acre, 10 acres, 100 acres, or 10,000 acres. You can make a difference. And I hope that out of all of this that you've learned about stocking rates and soil and microbes and worms and shovels and filtration, that you realize when you leave and go home today that you can make a difference as a result of the management and practices you put in place, because you're never going to stop learning. Okay? So I get the privilege today of telling you a little bit about what I got to do starting in my 50s. Now, my husband has done this all his life, and I say that with all due respect, this is all he knows. Ranching is all he knows. But I didn't join him in this endeavor until I was in my mid-50s, so I got to learn to be Annie Oakley in my mid-50s, and I'm still not a very good Annie Oakley. But again, you can do anything and be anything that you want to do. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit. We're going to get to soil health, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about who we are. Nathan and Charles asked for me to let you know what we do as in our ranching endeavor, and then talk about how those practices impact soil health. We come out of a holistic perspective. I don't know how many of you heard of Alan Savory, the Savory Institute, holistic management. Anybody heard about any of those things? That's where we come out of. My husband studied under Alan Savory in the 1980s. And there are two principles and six practices in the holistic management framework. And one of them, as you go through the endeavor, is to come up with what your holistic goal is, so that everything you do, from finances to relationships to grazing practices, all work towards the holistic goal you have. Everybody has a different one. You don't have to use mine. This is, but generally what we found is that everybody has some kind of similar elements, some kind of values and desires that are part of their holistic goal. Ours is, we have accomplished our goals and continue to be active and hardworking. The ranch is a place where our family, friends, and community come to joyfully participate in ranch activities and explore the benefits of holistic management. Healthy ecosystems thrive, resulting in productive soils, forage, water, livestock, and wildlife. Our community and our world see the ranch as a model of sustainable, ixnay, regenerative, achievable, and profitable management that's available to future generations. Wow, that's wordy. But when my husband and I sit back, and he's very sparse in his words, so he would distill this for you in about 3 or 4 words. For me, this works. This paints a vision about where I want to go and where I want to continue to strive to be in the practices and management that we put in place. Again, we're always on a learning curve. When we started out in all of this, when I came into this with my husband, Emery Birdwell, we were grazing for animal performance. I want you to remember the order that I've got these on here at the end of the... We were grazing for animal performance. What paid the bills? The cattle, right? And if you're in the kind of business that we're in, a cattle operation, we're in a stocker operation, I'll tell you about that more in a minute. We were grazing for animal performance. More pounds, more dollars. We would then realize that in order to get those pounds on there, we had to graze for forage, right? So we had to take care of the rangeland and the grasses and the forbs and all of the forages that were out there. We didn't know a whole heck of a lot about grazing for soil health, but remember the order of those. A little bit about us. We are located in Clay County, Texas. We bought this ranch in 2004. We went together. We lived two separate lives for the first half of our marriage, and in 2004, we decided that we would join our efforts, combine our careers, and we had the wonderful opportunity of being introduced to this ranch in Clay County. It was a historic, respected ranch. It was owned by Mr. Edwards and his wife, Dorothy. And I'm telling you, people up until not long ago continued to call it the Brian Edwards Ranch instead of the Birdwell and Clark Ranch. It was traditionally in a cow-calf operation since the 1930s, and actually prior to that, in the late 1800s on up, until January the 30th, 2004. And the last of the cows and calves were taken off of the ranch when Emory and I moved on. The ranch was without cattle for about 48 hours, and on Monday morning, 2,000 head of stockers arrived. And so it was a whole new world for these 2,000 stockers. It was a whole new world for this ranch. It's a beautiful ranch. It was a great ranch to begin with, tall native prairie grasses. It's bordered on the north by the Little Wichita River and cut in half by the East Fork of the Little Wichita. And there are seasonal riparian draws through it. You go out there and you stand out there and you can see as far as you want to see. And there are just tall grasses out. And it looks deceptively flat except for these seasonal draws and riparian areas that come through it. For Emory and me, it represented the opportunity of a lifetime. Emory is fond of saying that this was a real blessing to a guy like me who had spent his whole life sliding from rock to rock in the cedar and mesquites of North Texas and New Mexico. His background was different. It was from Palo County or New Mexico. He ranched in Nebraska. But when we had this opportunity, again, it represented the opportunity of a lifetime. But there were problems. You know what the two gentlemen before me have talked about? Continuous grazing. This ranch, for decades, had been in a cow-calf operation under continuous management. And so what we found when we got there were these large stands of moribund little blue stem, a monoculture of little blue stem. And at first I thought it was just gorgeous. It had this orangey color and it stood up about this high, but you started, and I didn't know anything. Believe me, I didn't know anything. I just married into this. I had no idea what I was looking at. And this is part of what I've learned, and my husband already knew, but what I was introduced to starting in 2004. So we had the problem here of these large stands of little blue stem, but not very palatable, no diversity. There were also the issues with a continuous grazing operation where water was scarce. They had built several large tank dams or ponds in critical areas in the ranch, but not all over the ranch. So when you talk about grazable acres, there were hundreds of acres of the ranch that weren't grazable because there was no water in those areas. And we were met with acres and acres and acres of bare ground. Emory decided, again, because I didn't know what we were doing when we moved up there, but Emory decided that the best, quickest, most economical, most productive way to change rangeland conditions was not to be in a cow-calf operation, but rather to have the flexibility of being in a stocker operation. With a stocker operation, you can move your numbers up and down, you can sell them, it might not be profitable, but you can sell them and you can come back into the market. And this was a way for us to handle the impact of drought, to handle the impact of our revenue, but primarily, it was the most effective tool to changing the landscape. We deal in high-risk cattle, and none of this is really germane to what we're talking about, but we deal in high-risk cattle. We buy sale barn cattle through an order buyer. Those cattle come in, and we have a low-stress handling policy. There are no cell phones, no yelling, no whips, no flags, no hot shots. Those cattle, when they get off, they're treated gently, and our whole endeavor is to make those cattle as calm as possible from the minute they step on that ranch. We have a health protocol and a feeding protocol that we go through, and that's not what we're here to talk about today. And after the cattle come into the pens, they stay in the pens and the traps for about a 2 to 3 week period, and after that, they're moved out onto grass. We start buying our cattle in September. This year, we were fortunate to be finished in January buying cattle. That was a whole different story last year. We didn't start buying until the late fall and didn't finish buying until the spring. So every year is the same, but it's different. But bottom line is we buy these high-risk cattle. They come to the ranch. We get them well. We take care of them, and we move them out onto grass. Sorry. So the second major thing we did, besides changing this historic cow-calf operation into a stocker operation, the second major thing that we did was we took this 14,000-acre ranch, and I'm sorry, you can't really see it very well, but 14,000-acre ranch, and it is, as you can imagine, this ranch was divided up into about 10 or 15 very, very large pastures. We started taking down permanent fence, which is what, a sacred cow, right? You never take down permanent fence. We went in there and started taking down miles of permanent fence, and we put in about 150 miles of single-strand hot wire. And we divided that 14,000-acre ranch from those 10 to 15, okay, goodbye, y'all. We divided that big old ranch in from with those great old big old pastures into about 140 paddocks. And we ran it originally in three cells. Might make sure I get the right button here. Which is this? I'm pressing what I think is the, there we go. So we were running this ranch in three cells. What I mean by that is, like, do y'all understand what I mean by three cells? We ran it as if it were three separate ranches. We had a west side of about 4,000 acres. We had a south cell, and we had a north cell, all existing in about 4,000 acres apiece. And in each one of those, we ran a 1,500 to 1,800 head of steers. We were doing that up until the drought hit in 2010. Everybody remembers that? October of 2010, did it ever rain again? No, it didn't rain until what, May of 2015? A little bit of rain in there, but we had those 5 years of drought. 2011, we're running those three herds. We're running out of water. We're running out of grass. And we have to sell one of the herds. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But Emory remembered what Alan Savory taught. And he teaches that when in a drought, combine your animals. Combine your herds. So we took the remaining two herds, we combined them together, and in 2011, we started running the whole operation as if it were a single cell. Meaning, we take our single herd of cattle, all of our cattle are in one herd, and we move them, golly gee whiz, y'all. We move those cattle. Okay, there it is. We move those cattle throughout the entire ranch as a single herd. And I'm going to tell you how we do some of that. Important thing to remember in terms of our practices is that even in the drought, our neighbors are destocking, and we didn't have to destock. Now, you'll notice this is a busy chart, but if you'll just look at the total head, there were some fluctuations in it, but for the most part, we stayed above 5,000 head even through the 5 years of drought. And I'm going to tell you why, because the impact of these grazing practices and how they provided insurance for us, a safeguard for us, so we didn't have to destock in the middle of the drought. And as a matter of fact, one of the years of the drought was our best year in terms of productivity and in terms of profitability. And we have never looked back from running that decision to run that single herd. There's a challenge of a big herd. There's about 5,400 head in this herd when this picture was taken. And there are some challenges in running this big herd. And as you start to hear me keep talking about the big herd, remember what I said in the beginning of this. It doesn't matter if you have 1 acre, 10 acres, 100 acres, or 1,000 acres. It doesn't matter if you have a herd of 10, 20, 100, or 5,000. You can make a difference, and you will adapt your management practices to go along with what you want out of your rangeland and out of your animals. But there were some challenges with this big herd. We had never run that many in one big herd, ever, and getting water to them. We told you that one of the constricting issues at the ranch was lack of water. So the first thing was learn how do you move this many cattle? Well, we started understanding that you can't get 5,000 head of cattle through a branch gate, right? So we stole this idea from YouTube somewhere. We don't even know who we stole it from. But instead of going around and cutting that single strand fence, which was what we were doing and it required a lot of labor to go back and repair it, we started putting this PVC pipe up. And training the cattle to move gently and easily underneath these pipes where the fence is raised. And I'm going to show you this. I think I have to get back up here to show you this. I wanted to show, just to give you a few videos to get a feel for what we're doing here. Yes, I did this with my iPhone, so it's not professional. But what I'm wanting you to notice is the calm, gentle manner that the cattle are moving. Again, there's not a lot of whistling and hollering. You can hear Emery calling in the back. They know that sound. They know that that means let's move to the next paddock. The other thing, and we'll come back and talk about it in a minute, but I'm wanting you to notice the quality and the quantity of the grasses and forage that you see here. A lot of legumes, a lot of weeds. Can you hear that? The dogs are out with us. Do you hear the panting? We take the dogs with us when we go do this. So just an example of a move. We learned how to move those cattle in a way that was calm, that was peaceful, that was deliberate, that was planned. The second thing that we had to do, remember I talked about how we didn't have water. So we started trying to get ahead of it during the drought. Well, how do we get ahead of this? The cattle, our 5,000 head of cattle are drinking out of a tank. And what do you think is the quality of water in that tank when 5,000 head of cattle are drinking out of them? Pretty bad, right? And also those tanks were drying up. Third thing is that those tanks weren't everywhere, so we couldn't use all the acreage of forage that was still available. So Emery had this brainstorm, and we started putting in 20 miles of pipeline. We started with PVC, and then we went with the HDPE. And we started stringing that pipeline. We didn't even have time to bury it. So we were hurrying, trying to get ahead of the cattle, move fast, put that pipeline out. We were running crazy trying to get that out there so that we could. And we started out by putting in these rubber tire tanks all across the ranch. But number one, they got to prove to be costly. And number two, we couldn't erect them fast enough to get in front of the cattle. So the next thing that Emery thought of was he took an old propane tank. He cut it in half, had a friend of ours weld it all up, and we started watering those 5,000 head of cattle out of this propane water trough. It's a mobile water trough. It now moves. We have three of them. They move around the ranch so that we're able to, in those ungrazable paddocks, those ungrazable acres, we're able to move this mobile water trough back into areas where the cattle hadn't been in years and years. So we get this kind of high-density impact of the animals in all over the ranch. Well, I can't say all over. There are those riparian areas, and so I've got to remember this grazable area, grazable acres. I'm going to show you this, too. And all of this has just been about so that you get a feel for what kind of ranching that we're doing up here. This is some drone footage that we took. Why do we manage this way? Why did we come up with this? We did it because we were forced to. There was a drought. We couldn't run the animals the way we were comfortable with. We had to adapt. We had to be flexible, like Charles and Nathan have talked about. We had to learn a new way of grazing because we knew if we didn't, we would destroy the rangeland, this great opportunity of a lifetime that we came to. So we had to be adaptive. We had to take some risks, and we had to monitor what we were doing when we were out there. And so why, it's what's the result of these practices? And what we've realized is that we were making changes to the rangeland when we were running three herds. Those three herds moving two or three times a day, we were making some changes in a beneficial way to the rangeland conditions. When we went to the one herd, which increased the animal impact, and I'll talk about that in a minute, it increased the animal impact on the surface of the soil, and it provided longer rest or recovery periods for those plants to continue to develop really strong root systems, we started noticing, exponential would be a dramatic term, but we started noticing change on a very rapid level, and changes that dovetail with the five principles that Nathan talked about earlier. We started, remember number one, getting armor or litter on the soil. Are you familiar with that term? Armor is what some people use. Litter, it's just the residue of the plant material. Getting that or covering your soil, whether it's in early succession grasses or forbs, or whether it's with old forage that you're tromping down so that you're providing a blanket, if you will, on the land. This is an example that we do when we have tour groups out to the ranch. We'll take you out there in particular spots, and we'll tell you to pull out your phones, and we'll get you to pull it up where you are on Google Maps. And in this particular instance, we had some students from Vernon College out there. So pull up on the map, and we looked, and we said, okay, what are you seeing right there? What do you see in that picture? Bare ground. We see a lot of bare ground. And then we'll say, look up. And they'll look up, and they'll look around, and what they're beginning to see is that as a result of these type of grazing practices and the management decisions we made, that animal impact, that rest and recovery, we're starting to see that that bare ground is being covered with early succession forbs and grasses. Now, these aren't ideal forbs and grasses, but at least they're the start of what Nathan and Charles have talked about of providing that protective covering for the soil so that we're holding on to our moisture, so that we are keeping temperatures lower for both wildlife and for just the microbes and the action that's going on in the soil. Again, just a broader view of that same spot where that picture was taken from Google satellites. This is another example that we got that in 2004, which was depending on how you want to call it, was the fourth year of the drought. You'll see all of the bare ground. By 2016, yes, we had had rain, but a significant reason why you see that bare ground being covered in the picture on the your right in 2016 is a result, again, of the grazing practices that were in place. How we treated that soil, how we treated that forage and that rangeland as a result of our cattle management. Is that graphic for you? Pretty graphic, right? That second principle, and minimize disturbance, that's what the guys would call minimize disturbance, and Charles referred to it as managing disturbance, because some people have a real thought that when you start really increasing animal impact and you start emphasizing that in your grazing management plan that you're really going to damage the soil. If you manage it, you are improving your soil. So well, this is a challenge, though, and we're looking at that animal impact. And I don't know if you can see, we're always looking to see what's in front of us and what we're leaving behind. This is not a labor-intensive management practice, but it is an intensive management practice where you, as Charles said, he likes to go home and he doesn't want to be out there. In this type of grazing, you got to be there. You got to be looking at and be, I like to say you get intimate. You get intimate with your ranch. You get intimate with the rangeland and with your forage because you're looking at the individual bunch grasses or the individual legumes that the cattle are eating. You're really studying to see in front of what's in front of you and what you're leaving behind you. Are you taking too much? Are you taking more than that 25%? Are you taking enough? Are you taking too much or too less? And so what Emery's doing is that we have subdivided this paddock with a polywire, and he's out there rolling up that polywire so that the cattle now can move from the right paddock where they've been into new pasture. Again, just another example of what is happening here is you're constantly observing, you're monitoring, you are making sure that you're making right decisions about the fresh forage, where they're headed to, and the amount of forage that you're leaving behind. Just another example of what's left over. That's critical for what your root development is and what forage you're going to have for the next time the cattle come through. I took this picture yesterday. We're still managing disturbance here. This is winter forage. This is the paddock that they were moving into and then what they had just left. And that may look like it's all eaten down over here, but this is beautiful. This is beautiful because, first of all, they're not going to eat all that old forage, right? So we need to get that old forage down so that photosynthesis can take place, so that we continue to provide that litter, that blanket, that cover for the ground, so that we're increasing the organic matter that's happening with the decaying and the decomposition of the forage and the interaction with the soil. And when you look over here, this is just, it's a big, beautiful, thick layer of grasses that have now been put down on the ground that are going to give opportunity for this new season. Important that what we're concentrating now is dung and urine out on the landscape, and we're doing it in concentrated areas. We're letting in the spring, we'll start to see the dung beetles start to come to work. But you're getting all that dung and urine in concentrated areas and the benefits of that as you move this big herd of cattle around. That third principle of increasing diversity. Remember those slide I showed you with the monocultures. Thank you. The little blue stem monoculture. What we started to see over the course of the last 14 years, and especially over the last 4 years, is this increasing diversity of forage, switchgrasses, all of the little blue stems, plains love grass. It's coming on in just exponentially again. I keep wanting to use that word, which is a little dramatic, but we're starting to see the diversity in the grasses, and not only the diversity in the grasses, but the diversity in the forbs. Forbs, another word for weed, wildflowers, whatever you want to choose, legumes. And very interesting to see what the cattle are now eating when they're moved daily or moved multiple times a day, that they're not just going to that same old little blue stem clump that was their favorite place to go. Again, just another picture for you in the springtime. This was taken last spring in one of the paddocks, and it's difficult to see when it's all blown up like this, but if you were able to zoom in, you would see the legumes, the forbs, and the different kinds of grasses that are in this picture. We found in 2013, we found our first eastern gamma grass. Eastern gamma grass in our part of the world is virtually extinct. She's one of my favorite grasses, and she is referred to as queen of the prairie grasses. Her protein level is really high, and it's one of the first things now that when that this is spreading across the ranch and the cattle naturally go to it because it is so palatable, it's so delicious for them. And the good thing is that we're beginning to see this eastern gamma grass throughout all of the ranch. It's mainly in the riparian, the seasonal draw areas, but it's scattering throughout the ranch. Again, we found it in drought. We didn't plant it. It was in the existent seed bed that's already there, but it was disturbed enough with this type of animal impact that it had a chance to grow, and we got off of it so that the cattle weren't constantly coming back in to keep eating it and destroy the roots on it. That fourth principle is aiding root development. And the biggest thing the dovetail there with holistic management is the whole concept of rest or recovery. As opposed to a continuous grazing plan or grazing system or grazing management practice, when you're moving your cattle in an adaptive multi-paddock fashion, or a rotational grazing, some people call it in high density. There are all kinds of names that go for it, but one of the things that you're doing is you have these short duration grazing and this long duration rest. So at any given time, All the whole ranch is rested. In the fast-growing season, animals won't be back on a paddock or a specific area for some 45 to 60 days. 60 is preferable. In this picture here, we were back in here on a 45-day because this was the 2015, and it started raining, and grasses started growing. And, I mean, we were moving those cattle 4, 6, 7 times a day to get them around the ranch. But you can see, if I hit the right button, you can see that all of this is little blue stem, and instead of it being that tall, brown monoculture, it is now in this vegetative state. There's talk at the local Dairy Queen that we have ruined the little blue stem out there. The reason why our fellow ranchers think that is because they're not seeing a lot of those big old stands of monoculture little blue stem. They're in this vegetative state where it's palatable again and it has some nutritional value for the cattle. During the slow growing season, we will have as much as 120-day rest, and sometimes that can even be higher. You can do the math. What we do with our cattle is when we buy them in September, we assemble our herd over the 4 or 5 months until January. They go out on grass. Those cattle are then moved out in grass and then moved multiple times a day until about the middle of July when we sell the entire herd. When we sell the entire herd, typically it's in the middle of July. We don't start buying back until September, so automatically you have at least a 60-day. But when you really realize it, we're in excess for the greater part of the ranch. We haven't been on that ranch in over that part of the majority of the ranch in more than 120 days. Make sense? So that is critical to aiding your root development. This is an iconic, old iconic slide. It's in almost every PowerPoint presentation you'll see. There were pieces of it in Charles. Teaching behind this, if you haven't seen this before, is that the cattle like to go back to that same plant. They like to go back to the same plant because it starts out and it grows and those tender shoots and they're juicy and they're nutritious and they'll keep going back to that plant and they'll go back to that plant. And every time they go back to that plant, they are destroying the root system. So that in an adaptive multi-paddock type of grazing and a rotational plan grazing where you're letting them go in there, your goal is to let them take one bite and then you're going to move them on. And in doing so, you are ensuring the survivability of the root system of any given plant on your ranch. That fifth principle was livestock integration. Well, that's all we've talked about this morning was in my presentation is livestock integration. That is the tool we use. We use those animals to get that high density impact so that we, along with long periods of rest, and we're doing so that we can protect the soils, protect the plants. You can't do that. You can't do that unless you do proper livestock integration, planned integration. This is a chart that's out of the savory or the holistic management context. And we have every paddock. We have 3 pages of this because there's 140 paddocks. We have every pasture on there. You rank the quality of the grasses and the forage that's there. When Charles is talking about what your dry matter is, you're putting that kind of factor in there. So you know how many grazable acres that you have. You know how much forage is available to you. So in that livestock integration, it's not that tomorrow you can go out and buy 5,000 head of cattle or 10 head of cattle. You got to do so in a way that's planned and purposeful. And in doing so, you're also, I know we've got some wildlife people in here. When you're making this type of plan, you can plan around the nesting season for quail. So if I don't want my cattle going into what I know is prime nesting season for my quail, I'll fence those paddocks out. So proper integration of your livestock in order to protect your soils, but it has many more benefits than just that. I hope you've seen that in the process of doing this, that there's an increased carrying capacity, but not at a cost. The increased carrying capacity comes at a benefit of the soils, and we're able to now spread our fixed cost out over more units. So that, do you think many young people can buy a ranch anymore with the prices that are out there? Second question, do you think a ranching operation can pay for the mortgage of that ranch? I can attest to you that it won't. More often than not that it won't. But if we're able to do a great, put in practices in places like this that improve soil conditions, but also are able to add more units, more volume over specific units, then we're increasing the possibility that young people might be able to come in and ranch and continue this lifestyle. Again, I said it's intensive, but it's not labor intensive. My husband and I and one other person work on this ranch. Now, in the last little bit, we've had a couple more hands than that, but now we're back down to my husband and me and a day laborer. We're getting 100 pounds of gain per acre. The average in Clay County is 50 pounds of gain per acre. I want to stress again that we're getting that 100 pounds of gain up per acre not at the expense of our forage or at the expense of our soil health. And indeed, what's happening as a result of this type of grazing management is that we're improving. As we said, since running the one herd, we're starting to see vast improvements with this short duration grazing, long periods of rest. There's also rest for humans in this way, and it doesn't happen always this way, but ideally, as I mentioned, we get to take the month of August off. How many ranchers do you know that get to take a whole month off? And so for us, and I have to remember that, in December when we're on Christmas Day, when we're out there taking care of those cattle and I'm mad and I'm upset and I have to remember, okay, August is just 8 months away. So for any given time of the year, we get to remember that we are providing that long rest period. And for us, it usually occurs from July into the end of September. Learning curve. Notice the way we have them on here now. Emery and I, again, in our 60s, have learned that we are now not grazing for animal performance. We are grazing for soil health. If we're grazing for soil health, we are going to improve the forage abundance on our ranch. If we improve the forage abundance and nutritional value, the quality and quantity and diversity of our plants, we're going to improve the animal performance. And what pays for the ranch? That animal performance. So it's a learning curve that we've had to adjust to, and I hope it's one that you can find in your specific enterprise. And last of all, it all results in this nutritious, rich soils and abundant microorganisms. We start at the beginning. We start with soil health. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So you can see this is one of my artists over here. But I also recognize the way that the order of those went from grazing for animal performance down to grazing for soil health, and then you made that change as a change in perspective
and
how we're looking at it. And so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as we go about this, is that we do have to start changing our mind and looking at how we manage from a different perspective and manage for what we want. Finally, we want to talk about the fact that there's an art to all of this, okay? We've always heard that there's an art to grazing management and that kind of thing, and nobody's really ever explained it or talked about what that is, and the reason is that no one person can do it the same. But you can give any musician a piece of paper, but they're using the same notes, they can use the same instruments, they can use the same stuff as someone else. But it's the way that they put it all together that it makes something different, and that becomes their art. For us as range managers, cattle operators, it's how we put things together that becomes our soul, our soul health and our art. And we just hope that this will be something to give you an idea of how you can use those practices and turn it into addressing those principles. Concludes our session. We've got some time left. If there's any questions, we'll do our best to answer those.
We'll get Ms. Clark up here because she's the one everybody wants to talk to. Or at least should. Is this working?
Hello. Hello.
Does anybody have any questions?
Ms. Clark.
Told you.
Y'all probably, me and Charles can go sit down. Y'all just talk to her for the next 10 minutes.
Perhaps you'd address this when I came in late, but do you sell, and when you do sell in July, do you have any opportunities to sell to buyers that are grass-fed? And do you get a premium for it?
I'm breathing deeply on this one because this is a source of contention with Mr. Birdwell and me. Our cattle are grass-fed. They're not grass-finished. And remember, I also said our cattle are high-risk cattle, so they come in and they're getting vaccines, and we doctor them when they're sick. So right now, the marketplace does not exist for us to buy 5,000 calves that are ID'd, that we know how they've been treated up until the time we purchased them. And there doesn't exist a marketplace that we can sell 5,000 plus grass-finished cattle in 1 week period. The marketplace doesn't exist yet. There are people that are working on that. Alan Williams and some of those soil carbon cowboys that I referenced are working on a larger business paradigm that's trying to address how you bring grass-finished cattle up to scale. And they've been out to the ranch, they've looked and seen what we've done. And they're trying to put together, they have another business called Standard Soil, yes. And so if you go Google Standard Soil, those gentlemen are really working at how to take the grass-finished business to scale.
Did y'all ever use a herbicide at any point after you took over the ranch?
No, we don't. Now, have we ever used any herbicides? The answer is no. Well, we do individual plant treatment. There have been a few mesquites. We were blessed. This place is, as I told you, was wonderful to begin with. But there were some mesquite infestation on a minor level, and we've done some IPT. But we do not spray. The thing that we're learning is watching those cattle move in, that we can control a lot of the weeds by just what the cattle, not only they're trampling, but they'll eat them in an early stage. They'll eat a lot of those. Now, did we have some broomweed and ragweed? Yeah, especially last year. But you know what? We love our quail, so we are not going to argue with broomweed and ragweed.
Over here.
On your water system and moving your HDPE pipe, and what kind of water source do you have, and how do you move that from paddock to paddock, those tanks? Along with the pipe that's associated with the tanks.
Okay, so we've put in more than 25 miles of pipe out over the ranch. It comes from two primary sources. There are two large tanks or ponds. I forget that, you know, when you're in Texas, you can say tanks, right? When you're someplace else, they don't understand tanks. They think you're talking about a diesel tank. So we have two large tanks on the ranch that have, quote, unquote, never gone dry. And we take our water out of those. We pump them through the pipelines out to the mobile water troughs. And all across the ranch are valves that are strategically located between the paddocks. And depending on where we want that animal impact, we may have a 500-foot hose that connects, or we may have a 1,500-foot HDPE piece that we will connect just so that we can move those water troughs into different areas. That one propane tank will water 5,000 head. We have three of them, but we have three of them so that we can position them ahead of one another and be able to have them. Now, does that happen in reality? No. We're often dragging that water trough right along with the herd. But it is something to behold that 5,000 head will water out of that single propane tank. They take their turns. They come in and take their drink, and they back off. It's not a mad rush. It's just a really, really fascinating dynamic to watch.
I've got one question for you right quick. When you took over the ranch in 04 to present, what is the impact of the combination of herds? What has that done to the bobwhite quail population? How has that impacted the bottom line of the ranch?
You know, I would like to take a whole lot of credit for that. And so you heard the question, what's been the impact on our bobwhite quail? And just in full disclosure, we won an award for this big, huge increase in our bobwhite quail population in 2015. Well, guess what? My husband's very jaded. We appreciate the award. But I'm telling you, if Mr. Birdwell were here, he would say, it rained. It rained. And so I'm answering your question a little facetiously. We believe that really the rain is doing the best, that whole dynamic. But what I will share with you is that you're controlling the temperature on the ground with the grasses and with the forbs that are there. You're keeping that ground cooler. I sometimes think what's happening to us, frankly, is that we're getting too dense in areas where our baby bumblebees, you know, baby quail, baby bumblebees are about this big, that they can't make it through some of that. Now, Emory and I agree to disagree over that. And one of the things we have done is that we have fenced off those areas of nesting sites and to see if that had any impact on next season's quail. And yes, we had the big jump, but I think there were also environmental issues at play. I'd like to take a lot of credit for it, but yes, sir.
How did you get your lagoons established? Was that
natural? Question was, how did she get the lagoons established on the ranch?
No, it's natural. It's all there. It's in your seed bank, and again, that's a message if we can get out that you've got that on your place. Most likely, it's in your existing seed bank. It's just that it's dormant. And the conditions of your grazing practices have not had the benefit of, of disturbing that seed bank. But no, we've not done any seeding, no herbicides.
It's really right at 12, and so I don't know if you're going to be around in the
in the expo, so you can find Ms. Clark. Also, this would be a good time to come by the booth if you have other questions. We have people there at booth 1043 that can answer that, and we'll also be in the booth throughout the next day or so if you've got questions. So thank you all very much for your time.
Thanks, everybody.
We appreciate you.